Hello and welcome to the May 2014 episode of the Bike Portland podcast about bikes and low car life and PDX, taped here at Open Roads Broadcasting. I'm Lillian Kerbake.
I'm Jonathan Moss.
And I'm Michael Anderson. Each month, the three of us go in-depth about a subject that matters to Portlanders who get around without a car.
And we do it in the time it takes the average Portlander to get to work.
This month, we're talking about something whose influence on your life you may have never really thought about.
But something that Portland does actually do differently, and probably better than almost any of our peers.
Traffic signals.
From the special lights Portland uses to let you know if your signal sees you.
To the tiny signals we had to order specially from Europe because nobody made them stateside.
Traffic signals are a Portland bike perk that is really innovative, full of new developments and clever ideas.
We'll be talking about the ways Portland traffic signals have secretly shaped your life.
And the things Portland could do with traffic signals if it wanted to.
And what people tend to do at traffic signals when they're on bikes.
And what we think they ought to do.
Enjoy listening.
So we're so glad to be joined by Peter Kuntz, the manager of the city's Signals, Street Lighting, and Intelligent Transportation Services Division. And I want to say, I think I didn't fully understand Peter until I discovered that he was an Eagle Scout. Is that right?
That's true.
So not only is he literally helping tens of thousands of old ladies cross the street by the mode of their choice every single day, I feel like the practice of traffic signals is really consistent with the sort of quiet, useful ethic of Boy Scouts.
Well, it is important to do a good turn daily and
That's right.
always be prepared, Michael.
That's another pun.
I've been waiting my whole life to say that.
Lily, what you wanted to invite Peter, though.
One, because it seems like it would be really fun to have you on the podcast because you're a cool guy. But one of the things that I think about traffic signals is that they're the kind of thing that you don't notice if they're working well. And I think bikers are particularly kind of prone to that because we tend to notice traffic signals when they don't recognize us. Really interested to like get your pin in. I went on the traffic signals Paddlepalooza ride that you had last year. 40 people came out.
Yeah, it was a little bit overwhelming. It was surprising that we had that much interest in traffic signals.
I've been to an incredible amount of wonky transportation things in this town, but I felt like that was probably the wonkiest crowd that I've ever seen at anything, including like transportation trivia, which you are also the MC for, so maybe they just, the wonks come to you.
Yeah, I think it's one of those things where it's something that interests people, and we have something to share. We have some things that we've done that are unique and help to codify what people want from traffic signals, and so it's great to be able to share information like that.
And Portland's really a leader in traffic signal innovations and technology in some ways, in terms of the stuff we've got out in the street. And I just wonder if being in such a city where there are so many wonks and people appreciative of that sort of thing, and a place where we have lots of research happening at PSU, if that makes it easier to sort of be an innovator.
Well, it's something that we have a legacy on. My predecessor at the city was really a stalwart supporter of multimodal transportation, and it was really more pedestrian oriented and transit, because that's what he used to get to work. He was a daily transit rider, and when you have a traffic engineer, someone that's has a vested interest in any particular mode, you're certainly going to get the outcomes that are of interest. And so he's really, Bill Close was his name, and he was really seen as a leader in the field. And so I learned a lot from him and saw that opportunity at the city to basically follow in his footsteps and really push the city beyond where it's been and continue the legacy that he kind of started.
Peter, I feel like you could write an epic poem about traffic signals if you had to. What would be that theme of that poem? Could you like bring us to the most grand sweeping context of the traffic signal? What would it be about?
Well, I think I'd leave that to my fifth grader. I think she'd be a better poet than I would be. It does affect people's lives on a daily basis. It's something that from a transportation standpoint, we use them to get from where we want to go. And that's something that certainly, as you think about it, it's fun to be able to have that sort of a positive or negative impact on people's lives. You try to do your level best to be more on the positive side so that like Lily said, nobody recognizes them because they're just working really well. So there's a little bit of a satisfaction when you don't get a lot of complaints that you just have to day to day just appreciate.
Something I've been thinking about with traffic signals is that we spend a lot of time on this protected like bike lane debate, and we spend a lot of time talking about concrete and pouring concrete and getting rid of concrete and all sorts of things around physical infrastructure, and we rarely address signals outside of the context of a project. You know, we talk about them with the 20s bikeway because we want to talk about hawk signals or whatever. But
they're a huge expense. Right?
Yeah, they're a huge expense if you want to put them in. But right. The marginal cost of changing a signal is very, very low compared to almost any other transportation improvement you can do. So, and it requires some of the least amount of bureaucracy, I think. Correct me here if I'm wrong, but like
flippy switches.
Yeah, it's really it's actually flipping like actual switches, right?
Yeah, it is. That was supposed to be
I like to call it invisible urbanism. It's something that certainly if you Good think one. About it, I can change traffic signal timing and nobody really notices. I may get one or two complaints, but a lot of times it's just transparent. It's just something that people think I'm doing a reasonable job with the limited capacity that I have at the intersection for time. And so it's something that comes out as in terms of there's all these assumptions that go into setting the knobs. Where do you set the knob? Well, what's the speed that you're assuming people are traveling at? Who are you thinking is going to be there? So all these factors that come into play that go into our models and then we explore what happens there.
So speaking of flipping switches, like be honest, Peter. So like if you're at a party or something, do people like pull you aside and tell you their pet peeve signal and they're like, hey, I need a little more green time at 13th and Harrison. Could you help me out here?
Everybody always has a favorite signal and people say, well, I don't want to bother you with it. But I don't know. To me, it's something that I relish the opportunity to help them. And so I think I try to gather input. That's one of the reasons I go to Breakfast on the Bridges every last Friday of every month, is just to check in with people and see if there's things that they have thought of or things that we've done that maybe aren't so smart. So we try to gather input because we don't get a lot of complaints. And it could be a lonely job if you don't have that feedback and that even the positive reinforcement of, yeah, I like what you're doing here. Thanks a lot for doing that.
So what are the things we have done here? Let's talk about that a little bit. If we can rattle off some of the weird signal stuff in Portland.
So I think people that aren't in charge of it should come up with what they think it is, and then Peter can fill us in with the stuff that we missed.
Good call.
So I know we do green waves.
Green
waves is where if you're cycling at a comfortable no sweat speed, you'll be able to hit every green light on a stretch of traffic signals. And this is very abundant downtown. Like most of the signals downtown are set to be at a green wave, right?
It's like 12 to 14 miles an hour is the optimum speed to go on downtown.
Right.
Like that.
Yeah. Is that?
That's right. 13 to 15 miles an hour is what you'll experience downtown depending on time of day. And San Francisco has done it where they've actually signed the street for 13 miles an hour.
That's really interesting. Have you thought about signage here? That's not your budget though, right?
Yeah, signage is, it constrains you, right? And there's, you know, then there's that expectation. And so that's something that we've kind of stayed away from. We just figure that there's, if there's an opportunity, maybe we might do that. You can see signs in Astoria. Downtown Astoria has some old signs, signals set for 20 miles an hour. Klamath Falls the same way. So some of our older downtowns we used to sign and then that's just something that was done.
It kind of ruins your invisible urbanism, right?
Right.
Yeah, a little bit.
And I've always been curious on the downtown green wave. Was that speed chosen with a specific mode in mind? Is that a bicycle-related safety measure, or is that just a vehicle agnostic?
Really, if you think about it, it's the true application of Vision Zero. Because if you're traveling, if a vehicle is traveling at 13, 15 miles an hour, the braking distance is very short. Mm-hmm. So from a urban standpoint, it's really from a pedestrian standpoint, it's from a placemaking standpoint, as opposed to bike speeds. It just so happens that bike speeds are 13, 15 miles an hour. And they're actually not. Downtown Portland isn't known for its hills, but when you're biking, you can tell the difference if you're going downhill or up a hill, even if it's as slight as it is in Portland. So the speeds are different on a bike. So we have looked at some of those changes that might make it a little bit better for someone biking to slow down the speeds in select locations.
Yeah, I've definitely, I mean, I used to always know that from the BTA's old office at 5th and Everett, heading up Broadway, I would hit the, I'd hit green lights all the way until the hill. And then as soon as I got to the hill, I would end up hitting red lights. Mm-hmm. So.
And for what it's worth, for folks listening, I think it's worth mentioning, correct me if I'm wrong, host mates, but Peter actually rides his bike almost every day. He's just a regular bike rider around town. I think that's worth mentioning.
Yeah, I live in a part of Portland that it's actually fastest, it's cheapest to ride my bike every day. It's safe. It's on a path, spring water corridor. So, it's the engineer, the efficiency expert in me, says, "Gosh, why wouldn't I ride my bike?" So it's really it's easy to ride my bike, and I'm very fortunate in that regard. We chose to live where we do just because of that. I worked in downtown Portland before I joined the city, and it was just very easy to do. Although my father, who lives in North Portland, would commute by bike as well. So we got a little bit of a history here.
Got it in your blood.
So I mentioned that just to show that it could add to some of the sort of like awareness or urgency you have for bike specific improvements and stuff, which.
Oh, clearly. And that's not just me. I mean, you know, there's a lot of people at the city that bike that are in transportation and in the consultant community as well. And so I encourage the engineers that I've worked with, even if they don't turn into a year-round commuter, to try biking so that they get the experience and understand what someone on a bike is going to see and what sorts of things they're going to then want to design for. It's important to step out of your element, and even if, you know, if you're taking the bus every day, to do something different. Maybe you should drive in one day. Maybe you should bike in another day. So you're a multimodal user. You're thinking about it not just from one mode.
So let's go to the...
Yeah, I was going to say, that brings us back to kind of like what we see out there signal-wise when we're biking around the city. Lily mentioned the green wave. Another one that is big on my mind, because one right by my house, is a bike-only signal, which I guess otherwise known as a scramble signal, is the same thing, where you basically have your own phase of the signal. It's just for bikes and everybody else is stopped. There's one right near my house. So I've noticed those are great.
Yeah, we have 20 bike-specific signals throughout the city. Some of them have the green bike indication in them. Some of them are just green ball indications. So that's something that we're working on in terms of a standard nationwide. It's currently not allowed in the Federal Highway Administration's Manual of Uniform Traffic Control Devices. So that's kind of our
really. And have we gotten permission for those things, or have we just done them?
We did. We got the initial bike signal, 41st and Burnside, East Burnside, was a pedestrian hybrid beacon or hawk signal that included a bike stencil in them.
So we've got these bike specific signals that let you cross diagonally or make sure that traffic is stopped. The other thing that I really love is the detectors that tell you when the signal knows you're there. When I'm crossing out of the East Bank Esplanade or on the Tillamook Greenway, there are little lights that tell me when the detector underneath the street has figured out that I'm on a bike.
Are those the blue lights?
The blue lights, yeah.
Yeah, that's a relatively new thing that we picked up from Austin, Texas, of all places. So in March of last year, I was down there looking at some things that they had done, and they had implemented their first bike signal, and they wanted to communicate to people on bikes that they were going to be detected, that they should wait for the signal, because that signal, the controller had registered that they were there. So it was something that we're talking about including in that manual of traffic control devices. So it's coming. And so it's been interesting to see how that's, I've got a lot of good feedback on that's actually providing information that I didn't have before.
And so for folks that haven't seen it, it's a little tiny little blue light up by the signal head.
That's actually like up on the signal.
Yeah,
it's right. Not anywhere near where you're on your bike. So right. As long as you're staring at the signal, you'll see that blue light.
And you'll be like, what's that blue light?
Yeah. When it comes on to let you know that you're there and that it knows that's that you're there. And correct me if I'm wrong, isn't that to help with compliance? Because doesn't the psychology show that if people on bikes think that the signal's not going to change for them, they're much more likely to just run the light?
So this is part of a really inspiration we had from visiting the Netherlands. In the Netherlands, instead of a blue light, they have another signal head that lights up and says wait when you are detected. So that that basically that text in the another signal head basically is white and it says wait, and then it actually there are some of those signals that count down with LEDs around the circle.
Whoa.
And then when they count down, it then becomes green. So that's giving you really amazing information if you're on your bike that we see you, we're getting to you as soon as possible. And there are other countries that do that for pedestrians. And
there's also countries that do that for cars. I mean, in Germany, there's a pre-signal for all traffic at all. And it's just the yellow signal, but it comes before. It comes before the green as well as after the green. And it also confused the heck out of me when I first moved to Germany, because I'd be like, oh, it's yellow, I'll slow down and stop. Okay, now it's green, because that was the pre-signal I forgot about.
Yeah, I had an intern once that was from Turkey, and he said, why do you use sudden green? And I said, I don't know. What do you mean, sudden green? He said, well, usually in Turkey, we have a yellow that comes up before the green. So we warn you that the green's going to happen. So he calls our green, you know, the way we do things, sudden green.
I loved the pre-signals in Germany once I got used to them. I mean, it was an adjustment at first, but I quickly adapted. And then I was like, why is everything not like this? Which is how I felt a lot about a lot of German transportation engineering, but...
I kind of ride like that anyway, as if there is a pre-green little yellow.
We've discussed this before. You and your lack of traffic compliance. I don't know.
I loved it in the Netherlands and in Copenhagen. It's like, it's great, especially as a bike, because being on a bike, I think it's a little more preparation. And you also have the safety benefit of moving forward of the other traffic and assembling yourself and just kind of getting clear of that. And I guess if you're driving, it gives you time to put your phone down. I don't know.
This is where the concrete and the signals mix, right? Because if we had more separated facilities that are running parallel to car facilities, then you really run into the signals that give you pre-time and are finding ways to prevent you from getting right hooked when you're in a protected lane on the side. And we just don't think we have enough of that physical infrastructure yet that creates as much of a need for the bike specific signals.
But you still do have turning conflicts, right? So let's move into what could we do with signals? Like if we were dreaming, if Peter had an unlimited budget to do whatever he wanted with
just signals, traffic signals,
just traffic signals, nothing else.
Yeah, very interesting story. So I went to New York City a couple of years ago. They started with that sort of a construct of, gosh, we got to make this protected. We got to improve it. We got to make it safe.
Right.
And so that's what they did. They signalized every intersection, taking out this judgment of whether you should, you know, yield and whether that turning conflict was really there or not. And go back to traffic engineering fundamentals. We don't always provide a green arrow to really separate the time between a left turn and a opposing through movement. And the same thing applies for bike traffic. If there's nobody there, there's really no reason to delay either movement. So we really look at it in terms of the potential risk. We're assessing risk all the time in traffic engineering. And that's really trying to figure out, is it going to be safe if we allow that sort of shared movement to happen? Can you see the cyclist that's coming if you're driving? Can you see the other cyclist that's coming if you're cycling?
Mm-hmm.
So those sorts of things are, it's just risks. It's just trying to determine how much risk is there.
And you're weighing that risk against the efficiency of the signal?
That's right. So certainly when you separate a left turn from a through or a right turn vehicle movement from a bike movement that's going through, you're just trying to determine if that's going to make it safer as long as you have good compliance. That's the trick, is if you separate it out without having any reason to do that, then you may not get good compliance. You may have people running the red because they don't understand why they're being stopped.
Yeah.
It's a traffic engineering. It's one of those hurdles with bike infrastructure. And I think I've had this conversation with Jonathan before. Is in some cases the traffic engineer is saying, "Well, if I build it and bikes are just going to run the red, why am I building this?" And so that's something that it's been a push and pull within the industry to really recognize if you build it, they will come, and if you build it and you design it so that it's intuitive for them to use, then it will be complied with.
Well, but one of the issues with traffic signals is like this unlimited budget thing is kind of hard, because what ends up happening is we're like, oh, well, we want to make things safer. So the first thing we're going to do is throw paint on the ground because it's the cheapest thing that we can do, thermoplastic in lots of places. And that's where bike boxes came in. I feel like if we had either the best practice or the budget to have bike-specific signals at high crash intersections where right hooks were a problem,
we wouldn't need the
bike
boxes. Maybe,
yeah, the bike boxes, either the bike boxes would be a component of that, or bike boxes wouldn't have been our solution. But bike boxes were perceived as a cheap solution to a problem that was, you know, immediately, you could have immediate implementation on it. Whereas like a separate signal is going to cost, it's like 40K at a minimum, can be up to 250K for a signal, right? So,
well, it depends. So we've been only applying bike boxes at signalized locations. So normally if you're putting a bike box, there's that choice of doing a bike signal. I think the challenge is really,
so it doesn't cost as much to put in a bike signal if you've already got signals there, right? Because yeah, you don't have to run electricity. Oh,
that's right. If the pole, it's really the cost of the pole.
How much is the light?
The bike signal itself?
Yeah.
It says about $600.
What?
Yeah. Yeah. The small ones were,
so it costs less than thermoplastic.
Well, but it's the pole. The pole is the biggest cost. We have to put a foundation
in
the pole.
He's an engineer. Light and pole are two different things. That's
right. Yeah, mm-hmm. you have to actually put the signal head is what I'm talking about. The actual red, yellow, green indications is a signal head, and that's what's $600. It's the pole that you have to mount it to. That's the most expensive thing. If I can mount that signal head to
an existing pole.
Then I'm really okay in terms of the cost. The cost is $600 for the head. It cost me some to get the wiring to it. That's true. And then there's some modification in there, but it's not a big cost if the equipment is already there.
So you're saying that like part of the reason that Hawk signals and high like rapid flash beacons for pedestrian crossing signals, part of the reason that there's such a large expense item is actually just because there's not existing signalization.
That's right.
Yeah.
Certainly if you're starting from nothing in the ground, once you have to put a foundation that holds a pole up, that's a big cost.
Man, you just like opened my world. I had never, like, I have stared at so many spreadsheets for so many committees with like the signal costs broken out, but never line by line. And I've always just been like, signals are really expensive. We can never have signals because no one could afford signals.
Well, that's why what I have been trying to do is try to find ways to use the existing signals and use them and repurpose them for the intended purpose of trying to provide, you know, more effective crossings. And so if you can steer bikeways towards existing signals, then we have an opportunity to do that less expensive than we would otherwise.
So why didn't we just install bike pre-green signals at all the intersections that have bike boxes?
Well, it separates the movement. If you're stopped there, it doesn't eliminate the potential. In the crash that we had at 14th and Burnside was a right turn where just the visibility wasn't there. So bike boxes do provide the improved visibility for that cyclist that's moving at the same time as the truck. So a pre-signal would do that. But if the truck turned right on red, then you wouldn't have that. You know, in the Netherlands, they have right turn on red restrictions pretty much ubiquitously.
And it's illegal in all of Germany too.
And that's something that, so it's a choice you have to try to figure out. Are we willing to make that trade-off?
Something I always found interesting, this is just a cultural difference in traffic signalization, but I had a friend from Italy who's married to an American woman when I was living in Germany, and me and the other American woman, we were talking about, oh yeah, you know, right turn on red, they don't have this in Germany, oh, it's so interesting. Her Italian husband, who had previously expressed that he does not understand the concept of not being able to set off fireworks whenever you want, wherever. Like, he literally was like, I don't, these Germans, they only allow fireworks 6 days a year, it is so crazy. And we were like, that's not that great, like, it's... And he's like, I don't know, you should be able to set off fireworks whenever you want. And then we were talking about this, and he's like, why would you allow right turn on red? That's barbaric. And we were like, the Italian just told us that our traffic law was barbaric.
Crazy.
Yeah, right. Too crazy. So
the interesting thing about right turn on red, though, is that if you can make a right turn on red from a pedestrian standpoint, if that right turn happens when it's red and don't walk for you, when you get the walk, then that car is out of your way.
Right.
So it's kind of a double-edged, it's a double-edged sword, for lack of a better term, that the right turn red can be a positive if you get that car out of the way if you're standing waiting to cross the street. So it's one of those where there's no one answer for that question.
Yeah. There's also that issue. I heard it the other night at a 20s Bikeway project meeting. Queue spillover.
Do you spill back?
What? You spill back?
Okay, yeah, you're going to have to define this in English.
Well, it's essentially, I think in Peter's signal world, it comes up a lot, where if you have a separate signal for bikes, that which requires more out of the whole phase that everybody has to go through, you have to add that phase for bicycle riders. That means there's going to be more people waiting longer. If those people are in cars, there's going to form a queue.
Yeah, there are trade-offs in terms of how we prioritize movements. And so certainly if you're trying to make sure that you have no congestion between traffic signals, then you're going to be worried about queue spillback. And that's something that is a traditional traffic engineering measure we look at very carefully. You know, in some cases, if you understand that it's like life in the big city, you know, New York City, they don't worry too much about queue spillback. It's just not a thing. They worry about queue spillback when it's happening at 3 a.m, as opposed to, you know, we have to make sure that at 4:15, it's not spilling back. I mean, that's the temporal shift of are we looking at the peak 15 minutes of the peak hour of the peak entire day, which is like less than 1%, which we don't design any other transportation facility for that peak 1% of the time. We don't design our shopping mall parking lots for Black Friday. So that's the sort of thing that you have to be, it's a design question, it's a design control question, and that's something we've been talking about with the National Association of City Transportation Officials. The NACTO Urban Street Design Guide talks about how don't just worry about that peak 15 minutes, maybe think about all day. Early on in my career, I was doing traffic signal timing for just that peak hour, and I wouldn't worry about the weekend or the we wouldn't think about it from a multimodal standpoint, but that's really changing our industry, and I like to think that I'm helping to lead that change where I can.
Let's move to the last part of our discussion about this, and that is, do bikers always run red lights?
I heard that somewhere.
Yeah, I think I've heard, and I mean, I've heard this as like one of the main political obstacles to getting anything for biking improved is because bikers don't deserve it until they stop running red lights and stop signs. So I wonder what the numbers show on this and whether there's any way to improve people's actual behavior or what.
Yeah, I think it's definitely based in the community that you're in, and so if it's the compliance of red signals will vary depending on where you are. But our research with Portland State University, actually it's the Oregon Department of Transportation sponsored research on the compliance of bike signals, looking at both specific bike signals, because there was some concern about that a bike-specific signal wouldn't have very good compliance versus just a normal traffic signal. So yeah, they looked at both those. They looked at all across the state in Eugene and in Portland and other in Clackamas County, the new bike signal that's there. So they looked at a lot of different contexts and a lot of different types of situations and found that the compliance was very strong, that the compliance was, you know, it could be as high as 98%, or and in some cases, maybe it's a little bit lower. So it's very site specific. And it's also a function of how much delay is there. The longer the delay, the more people start to think about running. If there's a delay and there's no reason for that delay, certainly that compliance may be lower. But we have had very good success because we have very low cycle lengths in Portland, and we tend to only have bike signals where they're needed.
I mean, we've covered, I know on the, when this was in the transition between being the Portland Afoot and the Bike Portland podcast, we covered this study, but the thing was that it's very much the social engineering around bikes at lights, is that they found that the compliance was lower when there wasn't anyone around, and the compliance was much higher when there was.
My compliance is much lower when there's no one around.
Mine too, yeah. Definitely.
I'm shocked. It's interesting because in as progressive as Europe is, they flash their signals yellow and red. Hmm. Yellow for the main line, so driving, biking, you can just go with caution, and red for the side street, meaning you have to stop. And that just essentially is responding to that behavior that's happening. From a pedestrian safety standpoint, we don't do that because that means the pedestrian indication is off. So if you
never get a turn,
if you're that 75-year-old right. grandmother that's trying to right. cross that street, that is now you're probably not crossing at 2 a.m. But if you're coming home at 10 p.m., if you're flashing that
drunk
signal,
pedestrians are pedestrians too. I mean, I know grandmas yeah. are our best.
I hope to be a drunk grandpa.
That's
in
right. That's right.
70
yeah.
years.
Yeah.
I'm with
so
you. I'm with you.
This is actually something I wanted to ask you, because I know that you're developing this new sort of traffic signal standard. Like, there's all this new discussion happening around traffic signals. But I was actually curious if you know how much state variation there is, because I came from Ohio, where One, you actually have a 3-second wait in between the opposing red and the green that you're given, which as a bike, it's kind of interesting. You can't do that start in the same way that you can here. You can't know that it's immediately going to turn for you. But additionally, where I'm from, we have the blinking lights.
So the laws are state-based. So some follow the Uniform Vehicle Code. Some follow variations of that. You know, a good example of that that's being played out right now in the newspapers is the yellow and red clearance times. Then Beaverton has had a federal lawsuit followed that filed against them about how long the yellow times are. And that's something that from an operation standpoint, from a signal timing standpoint, it does. It varies by state, and so we take extreme care to make sure that we set those change in clearance intervals to be spot on with what's necessary out there. In Portland, we have a lot of old intersections where there's no detection at all, so we're just running fixed time. It's not sensitive to how much traffic.
Do you consider that old, though?
Oh, yeah. What's old is new. I mean, it's actually something that folks have been saying. That's actually better because then you have more consistency. It's the age-old debate about pedestrian, commonly referred to them as beg buttons. It's true. Sometimes they're, you know, you have to push the buttons. So that's actually, it's something we're asking you to do. We use people when they push the button, we use that as data actually to look at how much their delay is, and based on their delay, try to do as good as
we
can.
So you actually use them as data.
We have been. We have select locations where we've had complaints where we then set it up so that it can tell us how well we're doing.
Can you guys tell when a kid comes up and hits it like a million times?
Yeah, we only get the one, the first one that we
want. I was hoping you would, then I could tell my kids, they know you're doing that.
Well, what I like to tell people is that if you the first time you hit it, you turn it on, and the second time you hit it, you turn it off.
Yeah.
And that's actually not true.
It's fun to say that. I used to always think about the level of trust it requires in the other pedestrian when you walk up there and there's already a pedestrian waiting at it, and you have to be like, one, do I have to engage with them and ask them if they've hit the thing? Well, I go hit it and show that I don't trust that they've hit it?
Well, it's interesting that blue light confirmation light actually part of that is also inspired by in a pedestrian button now, we get that LED light up. So you can some people put it, we call it a latching call, where you hit the pedestrian push button, it lights up and it can stay lit up. And it'll tell you that it's actually you've been detected.
As someone who doesn't want to talk to a random stranger on the street and ask them if they push the button, I love those things.
Yeah, it's something that again the Dutch have this mostly figured out. They've done various versions where they give you a confirmation that you've been detected. That in addition to the weight indication that I talked about earlier, they have just a white light that comes up when you hit some of those buttons. So there's various versions of this. It's just, you know, the tradition of traffic signals has not been to think, how do we make these as intuitive as possible for people on bikes or people walking? It's, you know, you can look at the red, yellow, green. Everybody understands red, yellow, green. But why is it that pedestrian signals have just two indications, an orange and a white indication? Why isn't it, why don't we have red, yellow, and green for pedestrians? It's because engineers at some level said, we're going to make these two indications so we can save money, and we're going to use different colors so we don't confuse people in cars. And that's something that, again, there's always that confusion of what does this really mean? And one of the innovations, of course, that everybody's seen now, but I think Portland was really early to adopt, is the countdown pedestrian indications.
So great.
Oh my God.
And it is.
It's really big for bikes too. I mean, it's great for as a pedestrian, but it's amazing for bicycles as well, because I use it when do you guys do this? I use it constantly when I'm on a bike to determine if I'm going to have to wait at a yellow or not. Yeah.
But it doesn't always give you the exact moment that it's going to count to yellow.
And that throws me off when that happens.
Yeah. At this point, know the ones that don't. Like, I know the ones that time out as pedestrian signals versus the ones that actually reflect it.
Me too.
Unless Peter flips the switch.
Right.
Yeah. The whole system is
gone. I mean, the challenge with all those countdown timers is that it constrains you. It fixes you into that requirement that you're going to have to provide that much green time. The downside of that is, from a fire truck standpoint, when a fire truck's coming down the street, I don't really want to give that much time to the conflicting movement. I want to get that fire truck to where it needs to go as fast as possible. Because if I'm if I've had a heart attack, I you know that that's number one priority. So yeah. For me, just me.
Yeah, right.
Not everybody else, just me.
Yeah.
No, but so from a life safety standpoint, if you think about it, from a fire standpoint, it costs them money, it costs the society money if we don't do that. So it's one of those aspects that from a fire bureau standpoint, we want to, in traffic signals, we want to be as helpful as possible to people. And that's, it's really, it goes back to safety of getting people response to what they need.
And you deal mostly with the roads that are going to be emergency response roads too. Cause I mean, that's what I find when I sit on committees is sometimes we're like, oh, it doesn't really matter. Cause this is like a level three, like it's like the third level of road that a emergency vehicle would use versus like Burnside, which is like number one heavy level, and most of those are going to be signalized routes, so you probably have to deal with that more than your average spread of traffic engineering.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, the Fire Bureau is a partner in what we're doing, and so it's something that we've they're top of the list in terms of priorities. We get feedback from them if their emergency vehicle preemption systems are not working. So we try to respond to those as quickly as possible.
Well, that was part of queuing theory too, right? Is there's always like the line item on it that's like, this is what the emergency delay is going to be if we implement this traffic calming device. So it's like, there's the Vision Zero side of things where you don't want to like just put as many vehicles through as fast as possible, but then you might also be delaying emergency vehicles that folks need access to.
These are all trade-offs that we have to make.
Yeah, that's why we have engineers do it. You guys learn a lot of math so that you can do that.
We usually, when we have a guest, we ask them to contribute a tip of the month, and you're full of them, I suspect. What's your favorite street signal-related tip of the month?
Well, it's one that I think you guys have heard before, but maybe your audience hasn't. It's the traffic signal timing downtown. So if you're one-way streets in downtown Portland, you can walk you can walk against the flow of traffic on the sidewalk, so in the opposite direction of vehicles or bikes, and the speed for vehicles and bikes in downtown streets is 13 to 15 miles an hour, as we said before. The speed if you're walking the other way is essentially about 5 feet per second, so a brisk walking pace, but you can walk basically against traffic and basically get progressed, a green wave for pedestrians, if you will, in downtown Portland.
If you walk against traffic on the one-way streets.
That's right. Don't walk in the streets.
On the sidewalk.
On the sidewalk, please.
Sounds like a good Walktober.
That's right.
Yeah. That's right. Oh, good call.
Cool. Oh, thank you. That was a great tip.
Yeah. Lily, do you have tweets?
I do.
From TriMet.
I will say I try to keep the tweets at the minimum of the negative, but TriMet had a meltdown.
Mm-hmm.
Last month with the light rail. So there was a lot of delay tweets. But I'm going to give two very positive pieces of TriMet information before I start with the negative tweets. I kind of miss the days sometimes when we were a more transit-focused podcast. And there's two really great pieces of news around TriMet. So first is that now on Transit Tracker, if your bus has just been canceled, it will actually reflect that on Transit Tracker.
That's so great.
Rather than just randomly disappearing, it'll show you that the bus is canceled. So the ghost buses are no more. Which is always, it's been a problem for a really long time. Michael's
TriMet would tell me that this was not a problem, actually, and I was like, no, seriously, it's a problem. But I guess
they didn't want to acknowledge until they had a solution.
Maybe
I think
that's it.
And then another kind of just cutesy piece of news is that the PDX bus, the wonderful app, third party app, the developer, Andrew Wallace, and his partner, who's a professor at Reed College, Ken Brashear, they got married on Monday, on the first day of gay marriage in Oregon. So I'm really proud of them. And TriMet even put this on their Facebook page.
Congratulations, guys. Thanks for making the city so much better, Andrew.
Yeah, thank you for all the work you do on that amazing app. TriMet tweets, Jones Rich, TriMet, Taurus, expect delays, Gemini, expect delays, Cancer, expect delays. Leo, you're a dick. Expect delays. Virgo, expect delays. Another one from Jones Rich. If today is your birthday, pretend your delay is our little gift to you. It could be three times as long, so you're welcome. Rusty is a cowboy. Two hip kids are sitting behind me, trying to impress on one another with their hipness. I'm in a heck you've probably never heard of. This dude abides. A guy on Max tells his girlfriend that he wants chicken for dinner. Her response, get a grill. Trimess. We at here Trimet love our Max, even though it can only run on schedule when it's cloudy and precisely 59.4 degrees outside. Mm. Ben Kittleson, 56. I think the Max driver just did a weather report and plugged the city fair and this weekend's Waterford concert, and I didn't hate it.
That's our show.
You can subscribe to the show at bikeportland.org/podcast and send us any comments you have at podcast@bikeportland.org.
You can spread the word about the show by searching for Bike Portland on iTunes and leaving a review.
You can follow me at Anomalily on Twitter.
You can follow me on Twitter at pkoontz.
And you can follow at Bike Portland on Twitter and Facebook too. I'm Jonathan Maas, Bike Portland's publisher.
I'm Mike Anderson, Bike Portland's news editor.
I'm Lillian Kerbake, your podcast producer. Thanks for listening, and remember to exit through the back.
Pass on the left.
And don't forget to thank your bus driver.
Sprocket Studios production.